This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Back in 1980, Porochista Khakpor was 3 years old when she fled the new post-revolutionary Iran with her parents. She's now 29, and her memories of that time are woven into her first novel, Suns and Other Flammable Objects. It's a loosely autobiographical portrait of a family like hers making new lives in America before and after 9/11. There's Darius, the controlling father who drowns himself in a sense of exile, alienation, the mother Lala, who would rather erase her past altogether, and Xerxes, the young son who has to somehow make sense of it all. Khakpor's tale is lyrical and wise and also funny in a way that sometimes reminded me of the terrific British novelist Zadie Smith. Porochista Khakpor, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
Setting a novel in and around 9/11 is something that quite a few novelists these last couple of years have done, avoided for the first couple of years and now are doing it in droves. Were you given pause by the enormity of that as a social fact to stick in a piece of fiction?
I have a feeling most writers started writing about 9/11 right after it happened. But because of, you know, the publishing cycle, it just takes a while for things to come out and editing. So I have a feeling more writers than we think wrote about it very close to when it happened. But my novel, I don't think, deals with the actual event, but more of the feeling in the aftermath of just being an unemployed 20-something kid, sort of lost, and
in Iranian specifically.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's, I think I deal with some of the humor. I mean, a lot of the pain in this novel, the mode that I use to explore it is humor. So, even though, you know, some people have been saying, is it a 9/11 novel? I also think it's a
9/11 comedy.
Oh gosh, yikes.
There is, in addition to the specific events of 9/11 in New York, there is quite a bit of war imagery and air raids and bombing throughout the book. Where did those images come from?
Well, my first memory of Iran, which, you know, was from when I was 2.5 years old, and it's seen in the novel too, was of Iranian anti-aircraft missiles hovering over the Tehran skyline.
During the war with Iraq.
That's right, at the beginning of the war with Iraq.
The Iranian war with Iraq.
Yes. But at that point, people didn't know there were friendly anti-aircraft missiles. People thought they were Iraqi jet fighters. And so my family was standing outside their bomb shelter, which was, you know, their basement of their house. And I still remember the feeling of being in my mom's arms and hearing her cry and just the feeling of that instability being in these rocking arms. So that was my first memory, and I was extremely scared of terrorists and bombs and all that stuff as a child. I used to launch into crying fits when I would even see a hot air balloon. I've often been scared of things in the air.
So when 9/11 happened, there was a lot of childhood Iranian baggage that was hit upon.
Absolutely, yeah. For me, it was my worst nightmare, like many people, because that's the whole reason Iranians came to the U.S. We thought, you know, we were coming to a land that was safe and free of terrorists. And it really felt like here the Middle East had come to us.
Can you read a passage from the novel?
Sure. Okay, this is from a chapter in the middle of the book called Hells. And the chapter is mostly, it's a series of vignettes about sort of apocalyptic imagery in the protagonist Xerxes' memory. And so here he's just talking about his first memory when he was 5 years old in Iran. His first memory came, according to his parents, from an episode experienced by himself as a 5-year-old. Night, and they were on the patio of the home they envisioned an Iranian-raised Xerxes is inheriting. Their neighbors were out in the streets as well. The whole city of Tehran was outside their homes, patiently gazing at the sky. Xerxes was in his mother's arms. It was a shaky place, her arms adjusting and readjusting, both rocking him and just rocking nervously. His father was at their side. But what stuck to Xerxes the most was the black night sky, perfectly black, for star showcasing back then, because Iran, as industrialized as it was still a long way from sharing the always lit pink-black of American skies that he would know later. interrupting the thousands of individually held breaths and eyefuls of aerial black. Suddenly, the sound of choppers and their respective, artificially created initial breeze, and moments later, a circle of pink lights spiraling around themselves in perfect formation. And then on top of that, add the tone and vibrations of his mother's sobbing, and then the echoes of people in the streets, waves of gasps and shouts and moans, groans, something, something defeated-like. He recalled the sound of women overlapping the sound of men. He remembered his mother choking her way through chants, a strange guttural song of some sort. With repetitions, it too spun around itself over and over in breathless utterance. And then just as they came, the lights disappearing right back into the sky, and then the memory folding over itself until all Xerxes had, years later, was the existence of himself as proof that things went all right that night in the end.
That is Porochista Kakpor reading from her new novel, Suns and Other Flammable Objects. One of the biggest subjects in this book, as in many, many novels, is memory. Darius, the father, exists in a kind of paralyzed state of exile, burdened by his memories of Iran. And the son, who resists his parents throughout the novel, is also burdened with memories, as it sounds like you were, from Iran. As I say, memory is a subject in many novels, but for exiles or immigrants or call yourself what you will, is that inevitably a big subject?
Yeah, absolutely, I think. I mean, you are bombarded as a child by your parents' stories, by their parents' stories. Personal history kind of suffocates you. I always wanted to escape from it constantly. I wanted to have no history. I didn't want to adopt my parents' memories. I wanted to start from scratch. And it was very important for me to abandon some of that Iranian imagery that was constantly coming up in my household and that was also felt very dark to me. You know, images of the Ayatollah Khomeini and talk of, you know, what Iran used to be like and what we lost and all this stuff. It was just so burdensome.
The characters in the novel represent sort of different points along the spectrum of eager assimilationists or not. The father, not very much at all. The mother, totally. And Xerxes, the son, somewhere in between. In your own experience of your family, how did that go? And what did your parents do for a living in Iran versus when they got to California?
Well, my parents were lucky to have connections outside of Iran, even when they were living in Iran. I mean, my father, for instance, got a PhD at MIT in nuclear physics. So he had lived already in the U.S. for a number of years.
You buried the lead. Your father is a nuclear scientist from Iran.
Theoretical nuclear physics. Uh-huh. Nothing to do with bombs. But my mom is an accountant. She just studied accounting in Iran and was luckily able to get a job as an accountant in the U.S. So they had an okay time. My mom and I became American citizens, rather, around 2001, just 2 months after 9/11, which was very awkward and weird.
How was that awkward and weird?
Oh, gosh, going into that Brooklyn courthouse 2 months after 9/11, I was probably the only Middle Eastern person in there. I think we all sang America the Beautiful or something, and it was just felt completely bizarre.
And you could still smell the...
You could still smell, exactly.
9/11.
Yeah, it was so... I thought it was so strange to get that notice from the court that I was supposed to appear in November of 2001, because I don't know. At one point, I had a fear that all Middle Eastern people were going to somehow be drafted from the country. I mean, you know, you were hearing so many things.
When did you realize you wanted to do this for a living?
Oh, it was the first thing I've ever, it was the only thing I've ever wanted to do. My family, when they were escaping from Iran and going through Europe and eventually getting to the U.S., I had to leave all my toys behind.
So it was a real escape.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They couldn't even leave via airport because the airports were shut down, so they had to get on a bus and go to Turkey. And I was this little spoiled brat in Iran who had a huge room full of toys and a million dolls. And my mom said you can only bring one stuffed animal. And then all they had on all those bus rides were markers and paper. And so I would just start rattling off stories, and my dad would tell me some stories, and then I'd collaborate with him, and he would write down my stories, and I would draw a little bit. So I immediately got into storytelling because I was just bored, you know, and I also didn't want to tune into the fact that my parents on some of these bus rides were crying and panicked, and, you know, they were scared 20-something kids leaving Iran. And so my father says immediately I took the role as a very, you know, three-year-old, as someone who was consoling my parents and kind of providing them an out. And it was a lot through my stories. And then when I got to the U.S. and I actually learned English, I just became obsessed with the language. And I was very eager to master it. You know, I was that typical immigrant kid who wanted to do really well in the U.S. So I, you know, started writing. It was the only way I knew how to play.
And did your parents encourage this English-speaking, literary, precocious 11-year-old?
Yeah, I think it surprised them a little bit because I was, as a small child, I said, I want to be a writer. And they didn't really know what that really meant. And then I had a great second-grade teacher who really embraced that and tried to get me to send my writing to Highlights magazine for kids. I got rejected every time. But I kept writing, and I always felt a little bit different from other kids at school. I always felt a little alienated, and my parents didn't really let me go to slumber parties or go out too much. So I would just go in my room, close the door, and write and draw for hours and hours. I almost envy my work ethic from that time.
Why wouldn't they let you go to the normal teenage events?
I think that's where you get some of that sort of immigrant fear. You know, we're in a new country. It still felt new to them. And I think they didn't want me to become too American immediately. Like, I know my dad was very much against me ever reading Sassy magazine as a teenager, and all the girls read Sassy. And
you seem like someone who probably did read Sassy.
I know. I've since read it, and I've loved it. But it was forbidden in our house. I could only read National Geographics, which he had tons of, and which I love.
You begin this novel with a quote from Barbara Eden talking on The Larry King Show about her most famous role as a Middle Easterner on I Dream of Jeannie. What do your anti-pop culture parents make of that kind of mischief coming from their grown daughter?
They love it because they probably remember me being a bit obsessed with Barbara Eden as a child, and that I just loved I Dream of Jeannie. I love the kitschy, campy use of Middle Eastern imagery. You know, having a blonde genie was so bizarre to me. So I think they got a kick out of it. I also always like having a sort of celebrity cameo in most of the things I write, because I was sort of a pop culture journalist.
And again, stipulating for the listeners that you have a giant swath of blonde in your hair, which connects somehow
to
Barbara Eden. You're becoming Barbara Eden.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Pour a cheese to cock pour. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Porochista Kakpor's first novel, Suns and Other Flammable Objects, is out right now. And that's it for Studio 360 today. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Rob Weisberg,
Kevin Ryan,
Jillian Goodman, Ben
Conniff. And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, and SCG, whose charitable resources support FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, online at fjc.org, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.